Hey, Will, like I normally do, I just want to take a moment to tell our listeners to make sure they hit us up on social, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, wherever you might see us. Make sure you're sending us something. Also, you can email us directly at appalachiameetsworld@gmail.com. If you get a moment, shoot us a line, give us some feedback.
Yeah, and wherever you listen to the podcast, make sure you subscribe to Appalachia Meets World. It just helps our podcast, but it also helps you know when we're releasing a new episode.
The tradition has been like we don't have enough knowledge and wealth within our communities to have thriving lives, so we have to look for it from the outside, and I think that's not true.
Appalachia Meets World, a podcast about place and perspective, but always Appalachia.
And don't forget, Will, tonight's episode is powered by SOAR.
Shaping our Appalachian region. If you're an entrepreneur out there, especially in Eastern Kentucky, check them out.
Appalachia Meets World. We're back. It's Will.
And Neil, what up, my brother?
I guess the question is, how are you?
I'm doing better. I'm on the mend, man. Rising up. Not 100%, but I'm coming out of this thing. Very, very odd experience. Glad it's over. I can tell you that.
Painful?
Yeah. Anybody that ever says that it's not, they're liars. So...
Yeah.
Painful and awkward.
You got put to sleep, right?
Nah, I wish. Got nothing.
Really?
Yeah, it was not cool.
Well, I'm glad you're back. Well, how long does it take to get to 100%?
I don't know. I mean, a couple weeks, I'm guessing 2-3 weeks.
Have you filled out your bracket yet? It is probably the best week of the year.
I know it is. I've been so busy that I haven't filled out the bracket. I need to get it done since we're a couple days in. But you know, my bracket always looks better if I act like I didn't have time to fill it out on Thursday.
No, right? There's no correlation between knowing anything about basketball and actually filling out a good bracket.
That is correct. It's a complete guess in March, and honestly, I've thought about flipping a coin and seeing if I have better luck that way.
Yeah, someone told me the other day they picked the best mascot.
That's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but my wife usually beats me in the tournament brackets. And, you know, she doesn't watch any other team except the blue and white. So
you have the Cats winning it all, working backwards from that?
Of course. Of course. Yeah. I can't help it. Cats all the way. Can you imagine riding somebody else in that line? I can't.
No, I can't. Can't.
No, I just can't. Blasphemous. Do it. So that's some national news we got going on. Best week of the year. How about some Appalachian news? You got any app news for us?
Man, I'll just mention a couple things today. I want to keep it quick because I want to get to the guest that we have on tonight. I'm really excited about this episode. In regards to app news, just have two items. High Country Humanities is presenting a documentary. I don't know if you remember, if our listeners remember, we had Tom Hansel on a while ago. He was the author of After Cole, also did a documentary on it. Well, he is working with Kevin Kennedy and Yonda Montez. They put together a documentary in regards to interpreting rural life. It's called Documentary Filmmakers on Interpreting Rural Life from Appalachia to the World. I think they stole our tagline there.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, definitely after he was on here. But on March 22nd, which is today from 4:30 to 6:30, it's taking place at the Appalachian Theater of the High Country. They're going to have a screening in Boone, North Carolina at Appalachian State University. It's the High Country Humanities department there. You'll be able to watch it after they do the screening, but check it out. We'll post it in the show notes. One other thing I just wanted to mention this past weekend was the Appy Awards.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Did we win one this year?
We did not win in Best Podcast, but there were 50 categories of artists, including educators, authors, musicians, and much, much more. So there were 50 winners at the Appy Awards. It's a big celebration, pretty cool event. Not one that we've ever attended, but hope to attend next year. Maybe our podcast can get nominated and voted on.
Yeah, I mean, if I was voting, which I'll never vote, I'll never be able to, but if I was, we'd have to be listed somewhere there in the top Appalachian podcast. But, you know, we'll keep pressing on, and the people will realize sooner or later.
But we'll post that in the show notes. We'll post a link for all the winners. And that's about it for App News, man.
Sounds good, man. I appreciate you always bringing that for us.
Yep. But like I said, I wanted to keep it quick because I wanted to talk about the Industrial Commons. Really cool story. The founder has a really cool story. She started a company called Opportunity Threads that has led into the Industrial Commons, which we'll get into with her. But just a little bit of background. The Industrial Commons, they really found and scale employee-owned social enterprises and cooperatives. Bottom line, they support frontline workers to build a new southern working class that erases the inequities of generational poverty and builds an economy and future for all. So Molly Hemstreet is who we're having on. She's the executive director of the Industrial Commons, and she has a pretty cool backstory of how she came about, really focused on the triple bottom line solutions for business, for manufacturing, for scaling up in the historic textile district of North Carolina, which, as you and I know, we've had a few guests on before that has done manufacturing in North Carolina and talked about the history of the textile industry there and how it kind of went away and then is slowly coming back in small batch manufacturing. And this is a really cool, innovative way to do that in regards to social enterprises and cooperatives. So without further ado, she's the expert. You want to just get her on here now?
Yeah, let's do it.
On the episode today, we have Molly Hemstreet. She's the co-founder and co-executive director for the Industrial Commons, which founds and scales employee-owned social enterprises and industrial cooperatives. She's a native of North Carolina and has previously been a public school teacher, and in 2008 founded Opportunity Threads, now the largest U.S.-based worker-owned cut-and-sew facility. She also co-founded the Carolina Textile District in 2013, supporting the resurgence of textiles across the Carolinas. She's, bottom line, an avid supporter of industrial workers across the region, and I hear she plays the pretty mean fiddle as well. Molly, thank you so much for being on the episode, for taking time for us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I look forward to our conversation.
Neil and I, our family, we're big on history, like most Appalachians, big on tradition. One of the traditions we have appetizers at the holidays. We have this gigantic spread of appetizers, bigger than the meal. So we wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite appetizer or just holiday dish?
Oh, wow. I guess there's like this, when you said that, there's this one that like pops into my mind. It's like the cream cheese roll with the hot pepper jelly on it.
Yeah.
With like the crackers, it kind of becomes like probably a bacteria fest pretty shortly. But that's what I remember is my mom like getting the hot pepper jelly at the farmer's market in the summer that we would get in the winter and through the you know, holidays, buying the Philadelphia cream cheese in like that little tinfoil wrapper and then pouring it on there. And we still do it today.
So good.
And I don't even know if there's any making to it. I think it's just assembly, which is kind of my kind of cooking sometimes.
Nice. You know, I mentioned that you co-founded and co-executive director of the Industrial Commons. So I wanted to ask you, just what is the Industrial Commons? How did it start? And kind of your background in that regard.
Sure. So I'll get with where I started, and then it'll explain a little bit more of what the Industrial Commons is. So like you said, I grew up here. So This is Burke County, so people have heard of Asheville. We're kind of down the mountain from Asheville, in the foothills. So we're really, I guess, technically kind of southern Appalachia as we go down the mountain. So if you go like to Boone, you've probably heard of Boone, and you go like straight south. That's where we are, right down the mountain from Boone, North Carolina. So growing up here, we had a lot of textile work, and a lot of that left. So we had about 40,000 jobs leave our 4-county area. It was one of the highest job loss rates, and this was in like the late 90s. It was one of the highest job loss rates in the country. So when I went off to school, I did have the privilege to be able to go off to school, and I was, studying. I thought I wanted to go be a doctor, but I went off and I ended up realizing I wanted to be a teacher. And when I came back, I was teaching in our public school system, and it was a hard time. Like, in the early 2000s is when I came back out of college and was here, of just like, how do you rebuild an economy, or how do you rebuild anything in our communities when the economy has really been pulled out from under it? So I became interested in this idea of like, how do you root wealth locally? I have the words for it now. I didn't necessarily have the words for it at that time, but that was kind of that drive to me, is like, how do our communities not go through these cycles of boom and bust? So I was really fortunate, in my work of getting to know a man named Frank Adams. He had been one of the early leaders of the Highlander Education Center, which is based in East Tennessee. And a lot of folks know the Highlander Education Center. It's really been a leader in social movements from early on. So he encouraged me to, think about like other forms of organizing labor. And at the same time, there was this kind of interesting side narrative going on in my life of there was a chicken processing plant, which is in the heart of our downtown, that was unionizing, and had tried to unionize and did unionize. There's a book written about it called The Maya of Morganton. But eventually that what happened is that even though they unionized, because we're in a right to work state, that union decertified and left. So it was kind of like, how do you organize labor in a place like the South? Like, are we just kind of destined to be unorganized? But we have these, deep histories of organizing. So I became very interested in this model of employee ownership. Like, if folks are organized, can they, ultimately kind of take on some of the ability to run their own facilities? We set out to try to do that, and I worked with, in this case, I worked with a group of immigrant workers, because a lot of those folks were folks that I was working with in the public school system, and they had a lot of sewing. And so we started Opportunity Threads, which I knew I wanted to start it with like this triple bottom line of people, profit, or I've kind of started using like prosperity, because I think we have kind of a unhealthy idea of what profit means in the United States. So people, prosperity, and the planet. And so starting out a cut and sew facility that could do those three things, and it's done really well and grown. And knowing from the beginning, I wanted to be able to create a facility or a plant that could be left in the hands of the people that were running it every day and who were really building it and doing that work. So that's where Opportunity Threads start. And then I met Sarah, who's now the co-executive director of the Industrial Commons, and we started the Carolina Textile District with the same kind of idea of co-opetition. Like, we're better when we're together, and we also need to be, understand we have different businesses to run. So we developed this network, really a network of small producers. And then someone, it was actually Earl Gohl out of the Appalachian Regional Commission, that'd be another great person for y'all to interview, but said they wanted to give us resources. So we built a 501c3 that could start to house more projects like we're doing. And now we're up to about 30 people. And we have two parts. We start and incubate community-run cooperatives. And then we also do a lot of work with the next generation of workers. We work with about 1,100 youth every month and helping them find work, think about pathways to work, and really engage in our community. So that's how we got to the Industrial Commons.
That's very cool. I'm glad you mentioned the social enterprise aspect, the triple bottom line, but also the cooperatives and how you structure that. So I'm currently in Northeast Ohio. When I first came here, I started working for the city of Cleveland. When I was working there, we started the Evergreen Cooperative, which is a national model for the cooperative aspect of workforce. Even in those early days of the Evergreen model, several of the cooperatives struggled to survive. How do you sustain the cooperatives that you say you have roughly 30 within an industrial commons, 30 employers?
Yeah, well, employees within the industrial commons. So one of our co-ops has like 50 folks. And right now, and we're, so the industrial commons has both folks that are working in the enterprises and then also folks that are running the programs. So, and then, you know, what we have another part of our work that is called conversions. So we actually go and work with business owners that want to sell to their employees. So that's another piece of the work that we're working on. So, you know, arguably we're still small. So I would say there's a couple different parts of the work. One of them is what we do feel like we like to talk about as community-owned enterprises, because part of how we help these cooperatives like survive is the 501c3 helps to like support them. And so they may be out on their own. We have a few that will be out there on their own and kind of autonomous over time, but other ones will always need the 501c3 at least to help manage some of their growth. And we feel like that's a way in order to root the wealth deeply in our community. Ultimately, also the board of the 501c3, which has community members on it and workers on it, has what we call the golden share. So if that cooperative decided to vote to sell, it would actually take a vote of the community to determine if that, you know, company could be taken out of our community or shut down or acquired. So I think what we're trying to look at is what were these trends in our communities that left people poor? It was, you know, businesses shutting down. Sometimes we have control of that. Sometimes we don't. It was also those businesses being sold outside of our communities. Sometimes that can be good. Sometimes it can't. Sometimes it's not good. Sometimes it leaves one family very wealthy and a lot of families, you know, very poor. So what we were trying to do is engineer structures that would like hold wealth in our community. And that's why several of the businesses we've started that the 501c3 does have a seat on that board and can help kind of decide, like help fundraise for it. So help bring capital in, capital without a lot of debt, because that's what we've also looked at is what happens with these businesses is they go out and they, you know, become, they bear a lot of debt. And so what we try to do is use the 501c3 to help manage some of the debt of the cooperative. But at the end of the day, then the cooperative has to like maintain its mission. And then the community, which is made up of the 501c3 board, is made up of the community, determines like if that, you know, that cooperative doesn't necessarily get to just decide to sell.
I think economic development has made this shift, and I think you're doing it beautifully. Economic development is always about jobs, 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 and workforce was all over here by itself. I think they've started to come together to realize, you know, they're better as one. Like I said, I think you have really done that beautifully in kind of a purpose-driven employee approach. I know one of the things that you have termed on your website, you call it workplace development. Can mm-hmm. you talk about that a little bit and how that's important to what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I would say like place is so much the secret sauce of it's who we are. It's why we decide to stay here. You know, I can look out my window and see Pisgah National Forest. Like it's why we as leaders want to be in these communities, why we want to be, have our families be able to stay here is that deep sense of place. And to go back to what you were just saying, like the tradition has been like, we don't have enough knowledge and wealth within our communities to have thriving lives. So we have to look for it from the outside. And I think that's not true. So it's always like, okay, when are you going to bring the next auto plant? Well, you're not, you know, like you're not. And I remember like, yeah, they brought this one cat. I should not say the name, but there was this one plant they brought here. And, you know, I can remember they brought it. They got all these tax incentives, all these buildings were redone to, and it created 150 jobs. That's great. You know, that's great. And then it left and it left its infrastructure. It left its workers. It left. And so like, imagine what our community could have done and the work that could have been created and the multiplier effect had they put those resources into small businesses or what, you know, networks of businesses, which is another really important part of what we do is we build businesses, but we build strong networks of businesses. So like we feel like if one if one business does well, then the other businesses start to feel the effect of that. So I do think the play space is very important, and we need economic development, just as you were saying, to recognize the value of investing in place and linking people together so that they are, you know, they're stronger together. It's really what we call an ecosystem approach, And ultimately it's more resilient, because that's what happened in communities like ours, is like you would have these giant factories of 200, you know, 200,000 workers, 5,000 workers. And when one shut down, like, you know, just whole communities were left devastated. So if you can think about more of like these small, nimbler, integrated plants of manufacturing facilities, and that is more the trend towards manufacturing, like 5 to 75 to 150, there's a dye facility, a very innovative, one of the most environmentally friendly dye facilities in the hemisphere, is right here in our community. You drive down Highway 70, there's this phenomenal plant. You know, it's 180 workers. It's the most sophisticated dye facility in the hemisphere, and it's not employing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. What you're finding is if the manufacturing that's left, particularly in textiles, it's often these very nimble kind of mills that are filling a niche. Now, you do have some of the very large, like weaving mills. We have a very large weaving mill here of 700 workers. It also happens to be employee owned. And so I think what's very fascinating is to build these, you know, a combination of an ecosystem that's small facilities that are very nimble, large facilities that have been able to be nimble well as well. And I think what's so interesting is then to, you know, think about the democratization of that workforce through employee ownership. And that's what's really neat, is to be able to see these supply chains that we've been able to build. So I didn't answer your question about workplace development, but I think what it gets back to is thinking about where you are and thinking about the engagement of workers as a part of your success, not like we have a business and we have these people and we have to get these people to do what we want in order to have a successful business. It's actually about the buy-in and the support and what we often use the term of like agency, the agency of that worker to be a good employee, but also to be, you know, for themselves to develop as humans, because that will make them a better employer and it will make them have, you know, a better life. And so we have done some interesting organizing models that have really helped support a lot, you know, help make a better workforce that we can see in terms of the data that we collect in these facilities. We use something called the Q12 that we go in and we help assess workplace culture. And I was really fascinated in this one facility we've been working in. We were trying to help them work on workplace turnover. So when we went in to develop with this program we took in, they had 60% turnover. Over 3 years, I think we've been working in them now, they are now at 9% turnover. And they accredit it a lot to like just a culture of where people want to come in and work every day. And so that's good for that person. It's good for that employer. It's good for the ecosystem of what we're building. And that's what I think we mean by workplace development.
Yeah, I've heard you and your, I think, co-founder say before, being big by being small.
Yeah, instead, being big by being small together and linking us all together. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the concept of how you're scaling what you do. It's kind of what you just described. But also, you know, you mentioned the textile industry. Appalachia, a lot of communities are kind of built on these extractive economies that will take without giving much back in regards to prosperity, like you were mentioning. But there's also this cultural aspect of these industries that we're very proud of, the work side of those industries as miners, as loggers, etc. There's this cultural heritage. I mentioned before we had reimagined Appalachia on previously, and that term reimagine, while we want to think about the future, think about the just transition that Appalachia needs to do, I think we also don't want to forget about our past and the heritage, that the strong heritage that we have. Is that something that you think about when you do the work that you do with the industrial commons?
I think about it all the time. So yes, the answer would be yes, Will. like the facility I'm sitting in right now, when I was growing up, it was a shoe factory. It was one of the last shoe factories, Carolina Shoe. And then it sat here. I mean, that closed down. It became a weaving mill that moved, and then it sat here empty. And so we moved in with our facility, like with our new projects. We're also working on developing a brownfield, which was a furniture factory. I think there were like 2,000 people that worked there. It was a Drexel Heritage site. When that work left, that factory sat there, and then it burned down, and now it's a brownfield that we're looking to redevelop. So I think there's something about like the infrastructure, and to your point, like this just cultural pride and making things. We particularly saw that during the pandemic, when no one could make like masks and gowns. And it was actually our network, again, to your point of being big by being small together, that was able to get a contract with the state very quickly and put 60 mills to work making masks and gowns that went out to all the daycares before, you know, other people were able to do that, because we still were able to make things. It's something about our world has gotten so technological, and we're just, you know, we're trading in ideas and technologies, and nothing that you can hold up, you can hold, but, you know, to sit down in a well-made chair, or like the table I made, or to put on, you know, something that someone has cared for, there's a real tangible nature, I think, to the work that we do that is a lot of pride in it.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. It's been extractive. And so what I'm really excited about, and this is unique, I think, particularly in the textile industry, because there's such a future towards sustainability and sustainable fibers and the future of circularity. And it's not often that you have a silver bullet in terms of economic development, but the idea of circularity and where you can take your waste streams and turn them into your raw material streams, the textile industry is very ripe for that right now. And I'm very, very excited because we have received a designation from the federal government. We've received something called the Engines Award, of where they have chosen 10 sites across the United States to be designated as a region to try to be an engine for like a new type of work. But in our case, it's greening the textile industry in order to really build out sustainability and circular products that can create a model for the US. And so what we're so excited is like, yes, let's take our heritage and our infrastructure and years, just like hundreds of years of knowledge, and let's use that to be an engine for actually more of a sustainable, like in terms of economics and in terms of environment, and let's really lead the country in that way instead of like extraction and pollution of our rivers. Let's use our infrastructure to like do a 180 and figure out how we can build some of the most sustainable fibers in the world. So I'm excited about that horizon.
Yeah, that's incredible. I'm also glad you mentioned kind of redevelopment of the brownfield site that you're on. I heard a quote the other day. Someone said the identity of your community can be found in the condition of buildings downtown. You know, we neglect the physical infrastructure. I think it says something about what we believe, you know, our towns deserve. And I know that you have something that's called Land for the Commons. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of the purpose behind that, to really redevelop underutilized properties in towns such as yours, but also to have an environment for workers to come to where they're excited to come to work, where they are reinvigorated to walk into a building that's not desolate and boring? Is that part of Land for the Commons?
You nailed it. That was it. Like, we're always, because the facility we're in, like, it's great, but like, we're always like arm wrestling for the office with the one window. Like this morning I have it. So most of this is like a bricked up building, you know, and this is a great, we've done a lot of work to like make this building more livable, but you drive by and, you know, we're behind a barbed wire fence. So it's not the most inviting place. Now, when you get in there here, it's warm and we're doing some really cool stuff, but you're right. The infrastructure does not embody the innovation that's happening on the inside. So what we are looking at doing is taking this brownfield and saying, like, yes, this was a very important part of our community for a long time, and we want to honor everyone that worked here. And we're actually going to put, you know, little mini factories back on it to create this new future of work. And it's going to be really cool to come here. It's going to feel good. It's going to, you can have, there's going to be sunshine and walking trails and things like that. And we're also trying to do it with some high environmental, you know, standards. So hopefully it will be able to produce a lot of its energy instead of being something that, again, is extractive. It can actually be productive in terms of environmental standards. So you're exactly right. It's also to inspire a generation when they drive by and they're like, wow, I want to work there. Not, oh Lord, am I going to have to work there? You know? Yeah. So it does speak to like investment and what we believe in. And if we are going to continue supporting manufacturing, what do we want those jobs to feel and look like? And to go into a plant and not see the light of day for 8 hours is not what we should be doing. So.
Yeah. I love that. It sounds like everything that you do at the Industrial Commons, everything that you've done kind of revolves around this purpose for work, like having a purpose for mm-hmm. work, you know, employment. I've heard also someone say that the Industrial Commons, the work that you do, you are practical innovators.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think, so we kind of started this podcast to dispel a lot of the misconceptions that people have about Appalachia, to really talk about the positives, and really celebrate the work that's going on here. I think Appalachia has a lot of innovation that's going on that people don't know about. Do you consider Appalachia innovative? And what does that look like? Does it look different in Appalachia?
Yes. I mean, I think I consider Appalachia really innovative for that very reason that you just talked about. It's like practical innovation, because I think innovation is often sold as this like far leap. And actually the best innovation is also often that next logical next step, because that's what makes it stick. You know, it's the next logical right things to do that you can pull towards a vector of, you know, change being different. Because when you take a leap too far, often you can't bring more people with you, or you outcost a model, or, you know, you've gotten out too far ahead. And I think what people in Appalachia are really good at is resilience. And I think working together and pulling along to each other together and bringing community along with. And so I think why our innovations can stick is because it's bringing more than one person out there. And that's also very important for us organizationally, is that we don't build, you know, organizations around identities of people. Like, we need to build more movements of people that are thinking this way around economics. So, you know, when I'm gone, there's plenty of people that can take this on, and other people that think this way about how we root community well. So in some ways I do love the, you know, the label of being practical innovators, because that at the end of the day, the point of what we're doing is to, you know, alleviate generational poverty, and we need to build practical steps, because that is what will give people hope.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect term for Appalachia. I think you're doing obviously incredible work at the Industrial Commons. I wanted to ask you, you know, I don't know if I always growing up thought of myself as Appalachian. When I moved away, it took me moving away to really appreciate Appalachia even more. And it's a place that I will, no matter where I am, will always call home. Have you always considered yourself Appalachian? And is that something that you take pride in? I think recently it's cool to be Appalachian, whereas in the past it might not have been. Is that something that you've thought about?
Yeah. I mean, maybe in some ways, you know, that's an interesting question. Like, I've only always lived in the same place. So I've literally like lived in the house that then my sister, you know, I did go away to college, and maybe that's where I felt like I lost my accent. You know, I kind of had to like get that out of me. And But I always knew I wanted to come home. So maybe there was a sense of, I think I've just peeled back the layers of it. So maybe when I was younger, it was more the cultural. Yes, I was in a bluegrass band, like things like that. But now where I am coming back to my life more as like a worker, I think it's a deeper appreciation for these values of resiliency and creativity and practicality. And like even the idea of the circular economy, like that's what people have done here for generations. They use and reuse, and you repair, and you get something and it's well made, and then you fix it and you care for it and you take care of it. Like now there's a fancy word for it. It's called the circular economy. But that's what people have been doing for generations. They've just like, oh, everybody needs to be doing that. Like in some ways, the circular economy, it's nothing new. It's what my grandmother did, you know? So, it's just been like rebranded. Like maybe we all just suffer from branding, you know, a bad branding in Appalachia, but yeah. So
farm to table sustainability.
Yeah. Branding. Like that's called a farm. The farmer's market.
Cool now, though, in the urban
environment. Yeah, it's cool now. So, yeah.
First, I'll just ask you a couple of random questions since you're a lifer there in North Carolina. What's your favorite thing to do in Appalachia?
I love to look for wildflowers. It was so funny because yesterday, I should have been a botanist. That's probably what my true calling was. I called because we were actually looking at, we were out trying to look for like bloodroot and, so my friend and I found this really good like patch of it. And I called my dad. I was like, come dad. I had cell phone service. It's like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm out looking for bloodroot. I was like, wait, that's exactly what I've been doing. So every, you know, we can just within a few minutes be out looking for things. So often my favorite thing to do is be in the woods, honestly. So
that's funny. We had a guest on, Luke Manjay, who wrote the book, Ginseng Diggers.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were interviewing him, he talked a lot about the commons, about how, you know, no one really owned the land and everyone could hunt for ginseng anywhere because it was commons. And that's kind of where your name, the Industrial Commons, comes from, right?
Exactly. And there's a really neat woman that has written about like the commons from an economic side, and she, Eleanor Ostrom, and she won, I think, the Nobel Prize in economics for it. Don't quote me on that, but that it was, I really read her work and was inspired by it. Like there are these geographic areas, like herding pastures or like she like lobster areas of like, you all have to care for it to last over time. And so I think what I love is the tension between like industry and the commons. It's like these industrial areas, we need to care for them just like we care for our natural world. And we need to use similar principles as well. So I often like to put those things together that normally you might think are intention, but it's actually, again, to use another environmental term of like the edge effect of often ecosystems are the strongest on their edges because they've had to learn to adapt. And I think if you take an environmental ecosystem and a natural ecosystem or an industrial ecosystem, and you put it like on these edges of mutuality and cooperativism, then that's what's going to make it strong.
Yeah, it's very well said. You've obviously thought about your work to a great extent. I wanted to fire off another quick question. What's your favorite place? Do you have a favorite place in Appalachia?
Like my grandparents, when I was growing up, they lived way out in Swain County, and they live near a Joyce Kilmer National Forest, which is like an old stand of like an old growth stand of, I think they're mainly poplar, but that's always been a very special place to me. And then we have the gorge, the the Linville Gorge. And that's just being up or down in the gorge has always been a really wonderful place. But nice. I can kind of walk out my backyard. The fields around me are beautiful too. So
I'll ask this last quick question, but I think it says a lot about a person. Cornbread or biscuits?
Cornbread with the sweet corn baked into it. So it's sweet.
Oh, okay. I'll let you have that.
With honey.
As long as no sugar, just the sweet corn, right?
Yeah. No sugar. Just you put sweet corn in it. That's how my mom made it. I don't know.
Nice. Yes. All right. I so greatly appreciate your time. And like I said, you're doing incredible work there. And I commend you for all your efforts. And I can see this movement taking shape throughout the region, not just in North Carolina, but West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania. this circular economy that you mentioned. But I wanted to get you out of here on two final questions that we ask everyone. What's the first thing you think of when I say the word Appalachia?
Plants.
Flowers, plants, botanists. It all comes
like useful
back to
plants. Plants that are often hidden, that have a lot of use. Again, kind of practical, but very, very special. Yeah, I think about flora and fauna, you know.
So we kind of ground our podcast on place and perspective. Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned it during the episode, but place is really important to Neil and I. It's really important to Appalachia. So we wanted to ask you, just where do you call home? What makes it home for you? What makes it unique?
Yeah. So I call Morganton, North Carolina home. And partly what makes it unique that's really special is the diversity that's here, the racial diversity that's here. You know, I married somebody that was from South America. My children grow up with a deep sense of place. They also speak Spanish. They're brown skinned, light brown skinned. And so I do think there's this sense of like Appalachia just being kind of white rural. And I think it's very important to know, like, Appalachia has a lot of different voices and languages and new histories that are part of it. And that's part of the richness that holds me here. So for me, Appalachia is this like constant, it's this resiliency, it's this practical innovation. It's all this, so also this new place that people are calling home for the same reasons that we love it so much.
It's a great answer. Another reason why we do this podcast is really to celebrate the diversity that people aren't always aware of in Appalachia. But Molly, I wanted to thank you so much again, not for only being on the show, but for all the work that you do for your area of North Carolina, but also for the region. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Will. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity.
Will, man, good stuff. Good stuff. Appalachia's always reinvent itself. And just another great example of wonderful things going on in Appalachia. So I'm really thankful that Molly took the time to come on with us and share their story.
She's been doing incredible, innovative work in that district, not just with industrial commons, but how it all started with Opportunity Threads, with building the Carolina Textile District, and now of what is the Industrial Commons, which has been around for a while. But it's great to hear what they're doing, how they're doing it, and how it could scale to not only that region, but other regions as well.
Absolutely, man. In the spirit of business, do you have any Appalachian businesses to highlight for us today?
Yeah, I do. Obviously, we talked to Molly in the Industrial Commons. I think we have to highlight Opportunity Threads. You know, we discussed that in the interview, and we'll post the link in the show notes, Opportunity Threads, and you can find out a little bit more in regards to its background and what exactly they do. But I also wanted to highlight a company, it's called Collection. It's part of the Industrial Commons. It's a social enterprise that's produced by that, but it's a project of the Carolina Textile District, which is, like I mentioned, a community of manufacturers in North Carolina working under shared values to make more than products. What they have is a collection of simple products, but when you buy from the collection, you're supporting ethical production lines, meaningful jobs, and the revitalization of the region. So they have some cool things online. You can shop there, but also make a difference in ethically made products. So we'll post that. Maybe check it out. They don't have a whole lot of products right now, but I think they're working on producing more. So check that out. We'll highlight Opportunity Threads and Collection.
Sounds great, man. I'm going to check them both out on their website. You know, good stuff again from Appalachia Meats World. I hope you guys will at least check out the places that Will just highlighted, and I hope you enjoyed the interview.
Yeah, definitely. Now, since I guess we're at the end, we'll end it like we usually do. Till next time.
Peace.
I'm getting lighter, the air's getting thin. Now I'm facing down with a grin. I've been in the city too long. Sidewalks and buildings and singing sad songs. Now I'm back up where I belong, in the mountains.